All right, thanks, Jamie. Morning. Morning. A little early here. Okay, I'm going to give you just a talk to you for a few minutes this morning, give you a little overview of the concept of resiliency. It's a way of kind of introducing the topic of our symposium. And certainly this is, unless you've been living under a rock, this is an issue that has gotten a lot of attention in recent years. A number of books, of course, this whole meeting has the theme of resiliency in relation to climate and climate change. But before we start talking about that, a little bit about resiliency. And I think I'll talk a little bit more about resiliency, what that technically means, but I think you all have a pretty good idea what that is. But I guess I'll start off with this statement that, at least in my opinion, I think most of our pasture lands, grazing lands, are actually quite resilient. And I think that's a feature of several things. So the fairly reasonably high fertility of our soils, the fact that most of our pasture lands receive a good amount of rainfall, and the fact that most of the species we use are quite stress tolerant, tall fescue being probably the best example. And so they can take quite a lot of abuse and seem to come back and recover pretty well, although I would argue that we maybe don't understand that or know that quite as well. But I think certainly, I'd hope at least most of you might agree that most of our pasture lands are pretty resilient systems. But that might change. Of course, this is what's going on with our climate. It's getting warmer and warmer over the last 30 years, and the trend doesn't seem to be abating at all. And of course, associated with that are more extreme weather events, and the fact that they're happening a lot more frequently. And if you're curious about this picture, this is the first tee of the Greenbrier Golf Course in West Virginia, and the top picture is in June, after it had really horrific flooding in West Virginia. There's some reports that this was not even a 100-year rainfall event, but actually, in some counties of West Virginia, actually a 1,000-year rainfall event. And of course, this is nothing new, but it looks like these things, kind of events, are happening more and more. And of course, the drought in Southern California, it's been going on for several years now. Many climate scientists are in agreement that global warming probably has exacerbated the length and severity of this drought. Of course, droughts are nothing new, occur all the time. But again, we're going to start seeing more severe droughts, longer droughts, and of course, more frequent droughts. And so what are we going to do about these potential changes, and how are they going to affect our grazing systems? And you can take that quote and see what it means, but things are definitely seem to be changing, whether they're getting better or worse, I don't know, but I think we need to kind of prepare for that. So a little bit about resiliency, and again, I think most of you probably basically know what that means, but it's just a hypothetical example here of forage production on the y-axis and over a 20-year period. And in year one, we have a hypothetical, very dry, extremely dry year. In year 11, we have an extremely wet year. And the system on the left has very low resiliency and resistance. And resistance is basically the ability of a system to buffer a stress. And you see that first year, the forage production takes a pretty big hit. And it takes a long time, almost 10 years, for that forage production to reach that hypothetical average, that represented by that black line. The same thing happens with the wet year as well. On the right is kind of the other end of the continuum, where we have a pretty high system with a lot of resiliency and also resistance to drought and wet year. You can see the forage production didn't take quite as bad of a hit that first year, and the system recovered pretty quickly back to normal. And ideally, that system in B is probably what we're after, the kind of systems that we want to be managing for. And they're going to be able to potentially deal with these more extreme weather events. So if you're curious about the sort of history about you know, stability and resiliency and ecosystems. It's kind of goes back to a lot of ecological work done by this guy, Charles Elton, who was a famous British animal ecologist, did a lot of his work in the 1950s and 1940s. He wrote pretty extensively about stability and resiliency in ecosystems. And one of the main points he made was the importance of diversity and biodiversity in plant and animal communities, conferring resistance and resiliency to those communities, and use the kind of famous example that, you know, if you see a monoculture of corn, you always see these devastating insect outbreaks to corn, but you never see a devastating insect outbreak in a tropical rainforest. And there, so there must be some value of biodiversity to giving that system some resistance to those stresses. And I probably don't have to show this audience the example of what I mean here, but I got a new tablet, and I wanted to try drawing on it, see how it worked, and so I drew this little illustration here. So on the left, we have a pretty simple plant community, monoculture of grasses, and on the right is a hypothetically more diverse plant community. And of course, if we're subject both of these communities to a stress or drought or whatever, of course, in the monoculture, we have the risk of really knocking out almost all of those species or knocking them down temporarily. Whereas in the more diverse system, we might knock out a couple of those species because of their rooting depth or adaptation to drought or whatever. But a couple species may hang in there because of whatever adaptation that might be, deeper roots, different leaf architecture, what have you. And of course, those remaining plants confer some stability to that system, and they continue to produce at least some level of biomass. And they're also there, present in the system, so when things get back to normal, the system can bounce back more quickly, and that's the kind of resiliency there. So just kind of a simple example of you know, the potential role of diversity and stability. So there's been some debate, particularly in the ecology world, about the value of diversity and conferring stability and resiliency to plant communities. But it turns out, though, that if you look at a lot of different studies, diversity does seem to matter. And this is a paper that was published in Nature in 2015, that some of our work at Virginia Tech, well, we contributed to this the study. Forrest Isbell put together about 40 different studies dealing with grasslands and biodiversity, and looked at how they were affected by climate. And this graph here shows the number of species on the x-axis and productivity on the y-axis. All those lines are all the different studies that were included, but the main bold lines are the averages, and in relation to different climates that occurred during these studies. And generally what he found, that there was pretty good relationship, positive relationship, between productivity and plant diversity, regardless of what was going on with the climate. If it was a good year, or if it was a bad year, or if it was dry, or if it was wet, generally speaking, the more species that were in that grassland community, the more productive the community was. And going into that kind of at a deeper level, it's specifically looking at stability and some of these variables and resistance and resiliency. The first graph there on in A is actually ecosystem stability, and that's just the variation of production over time. And again, the main the bold line there is the average of all the studies. And what he found was that there was a significant positive relationship between biodiversity and ecosystem stability. The second graph is resistance. And similarly, for all the studies that looked at, there was also a significant positive relationship between biodiversity and resistance. But the last graph there is actually resiliency. And the relationship was a lot weaker between biodiversity and resiliency. And in fact, the blue line there is grassland communities following extremely wet years, that were actually, the more plants you had in that community, they're actually less resilient they were following a wet year. And so there didn't seem to be, so that extra biodiversity did not really seem to be important in helping these plant communities recover very quickly. But it did seem to be important in terms of the resistance. So biodiversity seems to be important in conferring some stability to our grasslands, but we have kind of an issue with our pastures, at least I think we have kind of an issue with diversity, in that it's pretty hard to maintain a lot of plant diversity in our pasture lands. And I won't go into the details of these graphs. This is some work from Howard Skinner, just published in Crop Science. And what Howard did, this is actually a 9-year study. They planted a 5-species mixture and a 2-species mixture, measured a number of different variables, including how those species changed over time. And to make a long story short, essentially after 9 years, that 5-species mix became exactly the same as the 2-species mix, basically tall fescue and white clover. And, you know, I've seen this in my diversity work, and really it makes kind of a lot of sense, because in a fairly fertile grasslands, pasturelands that most of us deal with a fair amount of rainfall, in dealing with these really competitive, stress-tolerant species, typically one or two or maybe three of them tend to dominate the system over time. And so I would argue that it's pretty hard to maintain a lot of plant diversity in our fairly fertile pasturelands. And so with that, I just want to kind of illustrate a few points as to how I think we might be able to manage diversity in our grasslands, pasturelands, to improve their resiliency. And there are three things I want to talk about pretty briefly. The first one is to manage diversity, but just key in on maybe a few key species, possibly looking at diversity in a different way, not species diversity, but maybe cultivar diversity, and possibly looking at different grazing animal as well. And of course, with every good forage talk, we have to show this slide, right, of the different growth, seasonal growth patterns. And, you know, part of using, kind of focusing on key species is take advantage of complementary seasonal growth patterns. And probably the best example, of course, is, you know, combining cool season and warm season pastures to kind of add, fill in that summer slump, at least in the more temperate pastures, and to provide at least a little added stability in terms of interannual stability. And we're kind of looking at that in a different way. We started some work in Virginia with Sericea lespediza, and actually integrating Sericea lespediza, which is that green strip in there, planted into tall fescue pastures. And the idea here is to add a little bit of diversity in the form of Sericea lespediza into an already pretty stress-tolerant pasture. And part of the idea is to see if we can create a really highly stress-tolerant pasture system. Sericea lespediza, of course, is a very stress-tolerant, very drought-tolerant species that also is productive in the summer. And you can kind of see that here. This is just some data I just worked up pretty quickly. The green line is Sericea over 2016. The gold line is Kentucky 31. And the other greenish line is alfalfa, and we also had alfalfa in this experiment as well. And you see Kentucky 31 pretty much held its own throughout the growing season. We had a pretty bizarre growing season in Virginia in 2016. We had tremendous amounts of rain throughout most of the growing season, and then in August it just turned off and became just ferociously hot and dry. And you can see, though, the alfalfa, and this is under grazing, but the alfalfa really dropped off in terms of production, but was compensated for by the Sericea. And so, again, if you can kind of mix and match just maybe two or three of these species, we could at least confer some stability, added stability into the system to deal with these kind of fluctuations that we see at least interannually and maybe over time. And this is another example, again, just a simple mixture of tall fescue and alfalfa in response to a fairly dry summer. The black line is tall fescue in the mix, and the dotted line is alfalfa. And of course, in the spring, fescue dominated the mixture, but then when it dried off in the summer, the alfalfa compensated, went back down. And again, I think you can see that there's a little bit of added stability just by adding one species to that tall fescue or that alfalfa monoculture. And this is the other thing. We have lots of issues with alfalfa weevil in Virginia, and that's an alfalfa monoculture, and all that frosted leaves, if you don't know, is alfalfa weevil damage. But right adjacent to it is a 50-50 alfalfa and a fescue mix, and the weevils didn't even touch that mixture. So just again by adding, and this is nothing new, but just again by adding a little bit of diversity, we made that system a little more resistant to a pretty serious pest in alfalfa. So the main point I was trying to make with species diversity is that I think if we can target on a few key species that maybe complement each other in growth or other characteristics, we can add some stability to our systems. Another interesting idea is to, instead of looking at species diversity, but maybe manipulating our genetic diversity of our forage species. And this is some interesting work that Rich Smith at the University of New Hampshire has been doing, and he loaned me these slides. And Rich was working with perennial ryegrass. And what they decided to do was look at two traits of perennial ryegrass cultivars, heading date and winter hardiness, and create a bunch of mixtures with that varied in these traits. And the way they present it, on the left is the coefficient of variation of dry matter, and again, that's an index of stability. The higher the CV, the more unstable the system is. And now the x-axis is just dry matter. And so ideally, what we're really after is, if we put these mixtures together, we want them to be in that green quadrant that are mixtures that are not only highly productive, but also quite stable. And these are some of the results that Rich got. The red dot there in this quadrant is just a straight monoculture of perennial ryegrass. And the data is a little messy, but at least for a couple of these mixtures with the different cultivars, it did find that adding some genetic diversity to these mixtures actually conferred not only some added productivity, but also produced a more stable mixture as well. So there may be something to this, and I think it's something that we could do a lot more work on. And Rich didn't think that perennial ryegrass was probably the best candidate for doing this sort of experiment. They were starting to do some work on alfalfa, looking at the same thing. But it's something that we might want to think about. And then the last thing I'll talk about, and this is probably the area I know least about, is I tend to look at things from a plant diversity perspective, but I think we also might want to look at animal diversity as well, potentially using mixed grazing. And Jim Muir and Jamie, they put together an interesting review paper, just came out recently, and I got some of those ideas from this. But particularly thinking back to my our Sericea lespidiza experiment, one issue with Sericea that we're finding with our cows, at least, is that sometimes they don't eat the Sericea. And so you could put Sericea or a very stress tolerant species like that into your grazing system, but if your animals are not going to eat it, it's probably not going to be terribly useful, right? And so the idea is that maybe if we added another species in addition to cows, maybe goats or sheep into that system, those animals might use the less palatable forage and graze it more and have better utilization. And so you can still have that stability, but get better utilization out of that system. And I think that's something that we can look at. And I haven't really talked about forage quality, but that's something that we, of course, need to think about in our grazing systems. So to kind of wrap things up here, biodiversity is really just one aspect of, I think, resiliency. And of course, I think we need to approach resiliency from a real holistic perspective. And I think the other speakers you'll be hearing from today from different parts of the country are going to touch on this. But, you know, of course, managing soil fertility, matching our stocking rates to our forage, managing pests and all these things to really combine to create more resilient systems. And so just kind of a take-home message here. Again, I'd argue that I think most of our pasture owners are already pretty resilient, but this could change, and things certainly seem to be changing. And I think, of course, we need to be prepared for that. I think some diversity is a good thing, but in our pasture lands, I think we need to focus on a few key species to really enhance stability and resiliency. I gave some examples of that. I think also some of the solutions that we have to be simple, they have to be affordable. And again, you know, maybe focusing on adding one species if we're going to manage diversity rather than these, you know, huge mixtures of different species. And of course, got to throw this in, right, on research. You know, I would argue we still, you know, this is hard work to do, and we really, I think, don't really understand resiliency and resistance very well. We all do, you know, these 2-3 year studies, and clearly that's not a long enough time to really get a good assessment of stability. And so, of course, it would be nice to have more longer-term studies where we could really study these sorts of things. And Howard Skinner's study, that 9-year study, is a really nice example of really the kind of length of study that we need to do. I guess my time's up.
No, you have about 15 minutes.
I have 15 minutes?
Well, we'll have questions, too.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a half hour.
Then
oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. It's okay. You
okay.
Did well.
Okay. All right. So that's it. I'd be happy to. Okay. We take questions now, or we're waiting to the end, or
we'll have time for a couple questions.
Okay.
And at the end, we'll have a panel discussion as well.
Okay. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if you know, we always talk about diversity and we plot productivity as a function of diversity. I wonder what the role of the management really is when we do those plottings. In other words, you may have the same type of species diversity, but it's really the management that in the shorter term determines the fate of that.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I was, you know, trying to make that point with that simple little diagram there, that really management is really critical, and certainly if you really want to try to maintain some consistent species diversity or whatever kind of diversity, you're really going to have to manage for that diversity and manage it so that, you know, you can maintain that specific species composition over time. Otherwise, particularly if you're trying to manage for a really highly diverse system, it's going to, I think, reconvert back to a very simple system. So yeah, I mean, management is absolutely critical in this, I think.
I wonder if we could sort of piece out from all the data the actual management effects.
Right, yeah, I mean, that'd be a challenging study to do. I mean, I think if you could do some kind of a factorial experiment and manipulate diversity and different kinds of management to see what you see, what's what and what really contributes to that variation. Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to do, but I think, you know, management is a lot of it. Yeah.
I think the way Ken ended his talk yesterday was interesting, that he quoted that where it said, you know, well, unfortunately, we're part of the ecosystem. We're a big part of the ecosystem when we're managers. So, for better or worse, we're part of it.
We are. We are. And obviously, in agriculture, we're a huge part of it. So, right. Yeah.
You didn't talk a lot about breeding for resiliency.
Right.
You know, like corn, for example. I mean, most of the benefit of corn yields has just been coming up with hybrids that, you know, plow right through dry weather or wet weather. 30 years ago, that just didn't happen. They shut down and were done.
Right.
And I, you know, I think we see that alfalfa winter hardiness and alfalfa, you know, whatever. But don't you think that's going to play a big role as well, where we just start selecting for plants that can keep trucking?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly that's a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I would think that would be an important area to focus on. Of course, I think at least some of our species are already pretty stress tolerant. But you know, there could be other species. Perennial ryegrass is a good example of you know can we do a better job breeding and selecting for increased stress tolerance in those species. I don't know. I mean, I think that's driven a lot by economics, and I think we all know the state of the forage breeding nowadays. And I don't know, I think it would take a fair amount to get to reach that point, but I hope someone starts to do that. Yeah, Jim. I'm sorry.
One of the things, obviously, you know, breeding is becomes sort of expensive, of course, is you don't get diversity from the native vegetation, which, of course, that's what I'm interested in, so that's what I go through all the time. You know, it saves you a lot of time, a lot of money, which is great for the species diversity rather than cultivar. But one of the things that I've seen that's encouraging in our part of the world, Southern Great Plains, is that with diversity coming, interest in additional income from their land, comes interest in diversity. And I speak mostly of wild hunting and so forth.
Right.
And so in our area, cattle, of course, culturally is king. But when you come right down to it, they get a lot more income from, you know, quail hunting or whitetail deer hunting. And so for those, you need diversity, which adds resilience, not only to the vegetation, but also the income that they get from.
Right.
During our drought period in Texas, we really, in our area, didn't suffer economically as much as we could have because hunting went on, where cattle suffered.
Right, yeah. And, I totally agree, and one of the things that I try to sell, I do a fair amount of work with native warm season grasses, and you know, try to sell this to producers that, you know, in addition to using these native grasses in Virginia for forage, that you know, you can manage them to you know, for quail and to get some extra income by leasing that land to hunters, and some folks have actually done that and done pretty well. I think it's not quite as extensive as what you have in Texas, but I would agree. I mean, I have, you know, I've been focused mostly on our kind of more temperate pasture lands, kind of a different system, and you know, we don't we're really kind of working with an artificial, a non-native grazing system. And you know, in the East, if you don't graze that land, it's going to revert back to forest. So it was kind of a different situation. But I would totally agree that that's something that we could maybe do better on. I was trying to sell that. Yeah, Dave.
Kind of a two-part question. What role?
Man, I should have talked longer. I didn't know. I didn't know I was going to have 15. I didn't know I was going to have 15 minutes here. All right, go ahead.
What role would an increase in the diversity of the service play, and could we manage for that if it was helpful? But then the second part of that, what is that going to happen already with the changing climate?
So what was the first part again?
What could we change the diversity of our disturbance? We touched on that a little bit with multi-species grazing, but I'm thinking different types of disturbance, not just herbivory, but fire or traditional disturbances, I guess.
Right. Yeah. You know, and certainly, again, getting back to the native grasses, fire. I think is hugely important for their management and that sort of disturbance. Of course, in these days, at least in Virginia, that sort of management has a lot of complications with increasing urbanization and other things. So, I think we have to be. It would be nice to do. And I think good to do those sorts of management activities, but I think there's really some kind of constraints, at least in some parts of the world. Maybe not in Texas, but in our part of the world, that's kind of an issue, I think. So, yeah,
so.